This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri and the Birrarung people. We'd like to pay our respects to the elders, past and present, and to acknowledge that colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
Hey, welcome to Auspol Snack Pod, the podcast where we serve you up bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes. We're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook page. So if you hear us talking about the page or we're talking about memes, you have no idea what we're talking about, maybe join the page. I'm Zach Lesnack. I am a mod of Auspol Shitposting.
And I'm Noon, also known as I Know Funkenstein. I'm the admin of Auspol Shitposting.
Hey, Noon. Do you hear that?
I do, but I don't think our listeners do because we've got some sweet new mics that are hopefully eliminating the background noise. Or was
Damn, that's not what I was supposed to be hearing? We got some mics. I hope you're liking the new intimate sound.
Right up in your ears.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that though. We've also got our romantic headphone splitter, which, yeah, basically I've only got one output on my laptop to monitor the audio through, so I had to order one of those little things that, like, basically they're only marketed at teenagers. The only ones I could find on eBay were all like, if you want to split your audio into two channels, that's romantic. So I hope you're feeling romantic, Noon.
Always.
Yeah. So
not only do we have a new, like, tech setup, we also have a slightly new format for you this week. It's not that different, but it's slightly different.
Yeah, look, you know, we've gotten some feedback. Not everybody loves the whole snack pun part of the show, so we're going to, like, cut down on it and try to explain it a little bit better and maybe try to justify the name of the show by, like, incorporating this new structure, which is we're going to start off with an entree. Noon, what have you brought?
So I mentioned Clive Palmer being in court last week, and he's going to be in court for the next 2 months, so I'm probably going to be updating you with hilarious drama from that court case most episodes, because
you are a real Clive head.
I find him deeply entertaining. And he has done basically exactly the same thing in this court case as he did when he was a minister in Parliament, which is not show up and generally fuck around and be useless. And the judge has, like, on multiple days been really angry with him. He called in sick on Friday, and she was just, like, fucking furious about that.
Can she do anything about that?
No.
Just to use the journalistic term, admonish him.
Yeah, she definitely was admonishing.
An admonishment.
I think also, I'm not sure this is a jury trial, so I think the judge's opinion of Clive probably matters quite a lot. She also got pissed off with him this week because she was like, you say you're self-represented, but you're clearly consulting lawyers. So in future, on the documents, could you put your lawyer's name instead of your name?
Damn, that...
Pretty brutal.
Yeah, that's a good one.
She also got pissed off with him because, so he had a key witness who we mentioned last time has been under investigation and has basically, like, decided not to lie for Clive.
And oh, yeah, he's off sick as well.
Well, no, so the star witness is off sick, and that's why he's not coming.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I suspect that that is an excuse for...
it's obviously bullshit. It's just really funny
in public. Yeah,
both he and Clive have been like, oh... I'm not very good.
Yeah. So anyway, Clive and his team found another lawyer who's in Brazil, I believe, who is willing to, I probably shouldn't say lie on his behalf, to testify on his behalf, but he wasn't able to get to court before Monday, this coming Monday. And the judge has, like, again, been pissed off about that. Also, there's been some discussion of Clive's nephew, whose name is also Clive, who is an international fugitive who's wanted by the Australian Federal Police. He also looks exactly like him.
Oh, my God. Oh, when it said nephew, I was picturing a fucking teenager for some reason, but this dude is clearly...
Like, late middle age.
Yeah, he's in his 50s. How old is Clive?
Quite old. Yeah, he's like early 70s, late 60s, something
Fuck,
like that.
Look... I mean, I don't want to say that he looks good, but I didn't clock him for 70, if that's true. That's so funny, because the thing is that he's been paying this wanted fugitive of a nephew, like, $8,000 a fortnight or something
right.
like that. Like, even though there's like warrants out for his arrest. I didn't read it. Like, I didn't don't know any more detail than that. But it, reading that story and picturing it being a 16-year-old,
it's just also quite funny. I don't know which is better. This guy looks like he probably couldn't escape the police very effectively. But I guess when you're a rich man, it's probably easier than being a rich teenager.
Yeah. No, I mean, picturing this kid like trying to check into like the Hilton with all his uncle's stolen money, like fucking Home Alone style. Yeah, definitely not flying under the radar as much as like a middle-aged businessman. Yeah.
Anyway, that's nearly all about Clive Watch for our entree. But we've been hearing more about how he funneled money out of Queensland Nickel into his like more important company, and it's just extremely dodgy. And look forward to telling you more about Clive's useless legal appearances next week.
Thanks for that delicious entree, Noon. Hopefully this helps justify the name we've chosen arbitrarily for our podcast. And now it's time for
Shitpost of the Week.
What do we got this week, Noon?
Okay, so this, you know, sometimes for Shitpost of the Week, we do shit posts, and sometimes we do shit posts. And this one is definitely a shit post. So this is a tweet from Sherman Burgess, I don't know, the great Australian patriot who we mentioned last time. He's one of Australia's foremost Nazis.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. It's just he hasn't been around for a minute. He was replaced as head of UPF by Blair Cottrell, who we talked about last week, because Nazis just love a little bit of drama. They can't get enough of it.
It's true.
Sorry, go on.
Anyway, this is a tweet that Sherman recently sent about the Port Arthur massacre. So I'm just going to read it out now. He, meaning the shooter, had an IQ of only 70, yet somehow manages to perfectly headshot 30-plus people with precision aiming while they're all running in different directions? Even the best Australian military sniper at that time said there's something fishy about the deadly accuracy of how Seascape went down. Not even I would be able to pull off a kill count like that with all headshot precise kills. I should know. I am regarded as the best sniper in Australia, and there aren't many out there in this country better than me. Martin Bryant was definitely a government patsy.
I am regarded as the best sniper in Australia. There aren't many out there that are better than me.
Yeah.
More this just reminds rock me. Rock solid. Sorry, go on.
It's a bit of a tangent. I'll be brief. But Krav Maga, which is like a fighting art developed by the
IDF,
Australian military. So they claim that it's
jumping
the most.
In Hermione style. I know this one.
They claim that it's the most effective fighting art in the world. And all of the other martial arts compete with one another in MMA, mixed martial arts, and UFC, but Krav Maga users are forbidden from using Krav Maga in public tournaments because they're like, oh, you'll kill everyone and then we'll be in trouble or whatever.
You hear that, jiu-jitsu heads? You've been called out.
Anyway, I feel like this Sherman being Australia's greatest sniper is kind of similar. It's like, yeah, but I can't do it where anyone can see or videotape me, so don't ask about that.
Yeah, I don't know where he got his sniper training. I personally am shaking in my boots. I mean, I did mention that I haven't seen him for a while. Maybe that's because
he's hiding
so
in the
well
bushes
hidden.
Over the road.
He's been camouflaged so effectively. Yes, extremely shit post. From Sherman. Is that all we need to say about that? Oh yeah, one of the fun things about this microphone is I could do like farts with my hands. They sound really funny. Thanks, Sherman, for that amazing post.
Do you want to record it again, me reading it with you farting through it?
No, it's okay. It's cool. I think that two farts was enough. You gotta, you know, leave the audience wanting more. Not wishing they had less.
That's true.
All right. Stay tuned. There may be more farts later in the show.
That's done for our entree and shitpost of the week. So now we're moving on to the main course. Zach, what are we having for our mains this week?
This week for our main course, we're having freedom fries.
Oh, yeah. What's up with the freedom fries? What's the story there?
A freedom fry is when a French fry is set free. It's a bit of a deep cut reference to George Bush's popular decree at the time of around about the time of the Iraq war, and he wanted to invade Iraq, and France was like, nah, we're not really into that, we're not going to join you. And he was like, fuck you guys, I'm renaming French fries Freedom Fries. How do you like them fries? Relevant this week because a French journalist and his crew was arrested when filming a protest against the Carmichael coal mine being put together by Adani in central Queensland. And then he was later set free. So he's now a free French fry.
I think you justified that joke pretty well. That's, we definitely explained it more than the last week's.
Yeah. No, I do. I'm hearing it now. People are like, you should really cut that segment. You should cut those dumb jokes that you take you a really long time to explain. I just want you to know I'm hearing it now. And look, we may cut it in future. So Hugo Clément, hereafter referred to as Hugo because no one needs to be subjected to my French accent any longer than necessary, was filming a protest being staged by Frontline Action on Coal, or FLAC, against the Adani coal mine. And they were arrested along with some other activists. They were later released with ridiculous bail conditions, stating that they couldn't go within 20 kilometers of the coal mine, even though they weren't part of the protest. They were just documenting it. And then the media community arced up, saying this is an attack on press freedom, which is true, and it's good that they did that. But I did find it a little bit frustrating because while this was, you know, a blatant misuse of police powers in order to kind of crack down on a protest that was directly oppositional to government interests, the media is really quick to jump on this stuff when it's a journalist at the center of it. And I think a good example is this case itself. Hugo was arrested with his crew people, and then a stink was kicked up, and the French ambassador got involved, I think, and then the journalist trade union also weighed in and was like, this is a blatant trampling of press freedom.
Which
it totally was. And there was heaps of media around this. But the two activists who were actually locked on to the barrel filled with concrete, which was blocking the railway, which was the kind of central action of the protest, the coverage of their situation has been basically non-existent. They were also given ridiculous bail conditions. They're not allowed to return to the town of Bowen, which is the town nearest the protest site, and that was where they were, the police station was that they were arrested. Those protesters' names are Emily and Matilda, by the way.
Good on you guys. Thank you for trying to protect our planet from horrible climate change.
Excellent work, and I'm sorry that you, the people who actually did the protesting, are not getting the majority of press around this.
100%.
So, look, I do think that we need to be really worried about cops being used to crack down on people reporting on protests, but I really wish that we would see the media class gather so quickly, as quickly and effectively as they did to defend this journo, to defend protesters who are actually being targeted by these police actions, because this is not the first time that this has happened. We get this kind of weird double standard. So an example that we discussed on an earlier episode is these new laws coming in around that are supposed to be about protecting farmers' freedoms, is being championed by the deputy leader of the Nationals, Bridget McKenzie, which is introducing new penalties for people who quote-unquote incite somebody to invade agricultural property. So that's really
obviously a very vague,
really vague terminology, and journalists are worried about what does that entail. Now, there is supposedly some exemptions in the bill about, you know, if you were to report on something bad happening at a farm, for example, and then somebody reads that and is like, oh,
I'm going to go invade this farm.
Yeah.
Right.
That sounds kind of like incitement to me. Yeah. Right. But supposedly there's exemptions built into the bill, but it's fuzzy. So there has been some discussion around that because the media class is worried, obviously, that their ability to report on this stuff is going to be infringed upon. And we should be worried about that. But I didn't see anything near that level of concern or outrage totally being written about in the defense of the activists who are actually being directly targeted by this law. So my point is, if you're worried now, if you're worried, like by the time they're coming for the journalists and they're curbing press freedom. Like, it's too late. You need to be fighting this stuff when it's actually happening in the first instance, when it's happening to activists, because those are the people that the cops are going to come for. And they're going to come for people like vegan activists who they know don't have the general support of the public. And so people will be like, ah, look, fuck it. You know, these laws are targeting vegans. I don't like them anyway. And next thing you know, it's environmental protests. Next thing you know, well, look, it's a very slippery slope. So I think that we need to fight this at every stage. And I would love to see the media step up and actually take a much stronger stance on this when it's not just affecting their own people.
Totally.
Even though that is obviously a really important issue and they should be reporting on that as well.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's totally true. And you also sort of drew a link with the Jabiru'ng birthing trees protest.
Yeah, that's right. So this is probably even a more relevant example than the new agricultural incitement laws. So for those who are not familiar with the story, in a town just outside of a town named Ararat, which is about 2.5 hours west of Melbourne, the Victorian Roads Authority is trying to widen and slightly reroute a highway, a dangerous stretch of highway. And as part of the planning for that, a number of sacred indigenous trees that are sacred to the indigenous people of that area, who are called the Jabiru'ng, were going to be demolished. These are sacred birthing trees. Some of them go as old as 800 years.
Something like 50 generations of people have been born there.
Yeah. Mm. So really, and you know, very culturally significant. There's been back and forth about this for a while. Certain indigenous groups have been consulted, and other indigenous groups have said, no, the people you consulted don't actually represent us. So it's a complicated issue, but at the center of it is a protest camp, which has been established for about 13 months now, which has been set up around the trees. And there's sort of roughly maybe 100 people on and off staying there. And yeah, the debate has kind of shifted away from the trees now. I think the government has sort of capitulated a little bit and said, okay, we won't destroy all of these trees. We're only going to destroy a couple of them. Yep. And, you know, the traditional owners are obviously like, actually, no, that's not good enough.
None.
So sorry, that's just a little long-winded, but that's the background for that story. I encourage you to look it up and support them. Go to dwembassy.com, maybe .au, if you want to learn more about that. My point being that the spiritual leader who's kind of at the forefront of this debate or at this action and who's been living up at that camp at the camp for over a year, named D.T. Zelenak, was arrested on bullshit trumped-up charges, basically. I think it was for basically being rude to a cop and driving without a license,
mm-hmm.
Or driving with an expired license.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he was incarcerated in remand for like a month.
Whoa.
Yeah, intense.
And of course, we know that in Victoria, Indigenous people in remand are in danger of their health and life and safety.
Massively. And there was basically no press about this. He's been released and he's back on country and back at the camp. But yeah, that's a great example of the cops coming and shutting down a frontline protest. Or trying to shut down a frontline protest by basically arresting the figurehead on bullshit charges, locking them away. Basically, no press around that.
Yep.
Now, if it had been a journalist who was arrested for reporting on that protest, it would have been all over the news. So I do think that journalists in general and media class in general has a responsibility to step up and take these kinds of infringements on the rights of protesters and activists much more seriously, because by the time they get to you, it's too late.
I think also our media don't consider themselves to be activists, but I think good media is activism. It's speaking truth to power. It's telling stories that the government are trying to hide, and it's presenting sides of the story from people who aren't powerful and influential enough to have their voice sort of heard by the society in default. And I think you have mentioned, Zach, the media class a few times. And obviously, that's kind of a vague term, but most of our journalists, especially in the major institutions, the ABC, Guardian, and so on, the Fairfax and News Limited papers, they are friends with the politicians. They're like literally their pals who they have drinks with after work.
Boom.
And they hang out and they're friends. And like on one level, sure, like I understand that's sort of like important for journalists to get info or whatever, but they are moving away from the purpose of what their job is. And I think they get lost in the like dumb soap opera bullshit of Parliament House and forget that they're actually supposed to be causing trouble and
absolutely
not participating in that, but making it harder for people to get shit by the public unseen.
Absolutely. I think that kind of adversarial journalism is pretty lacking in this country. I think you see a lot more of it in the States, which is, you know, partly the nature of the political system, but it's also a result of an extremely homogenous media landscape in this country. And actually, as I was doing a little bit of reading in preparation for ranting about this, I noticed that Australia has slipped two places in the world rankings of Reporters Without Borders' list of countries, you know, how free their press is, basically.
Right.
And the explanation they gave was partially the Nine Fairfax merger.
Yep.
And also the secrecy around Manasseh Nauru.
Yep.
So it is something that we, you know, press freedom is something that we do really need to be worried about here. But, you know, we're at this stage now where, as you say, most of the press here is extremely chummy with politicians and with business interests. And sure, maybe there's an argument to be made for keeping those people on site enough that they won't refuse to talk to you. But, you know, if we're at this stage now where they're clamping down on protests and press freedom, when the press are really not challenging them very much at all.
Yeah.
You imagine what it would be like if, you know, we had some really, truly adversarial journalism in this country. And look, there are people doing really good work. You know, there's lots of journalists here that are in this country working who are doing fantastic stuff and that I admire and who even might work for organizations who I don't particularly like, but might be doing good work. And I don't want to dismiss or ignore all of that stuff, but I do think as an overall trend, it's troubling. So that's our completely amateur and uninformed opinion on journalism.
Before we our main course, maybe this can be a little side salad. that's not an official segment name, but sure, maybe it will be. I just wanted to mention there's been some reporting in the last 24 hours about Adani's finances. And this really has nothing to do with the protests, but the subsidiary of Adani that is creating this coal mine have something like $30 million in assets and $1.6 billion in debts, right?
So that's like a lot of debts.
That's a lot of debt. And it was an interview, I think, with the ABC with an economist who's been following Adani, and she was just like, yeah, this company is like mostly failed. So
why would anybody give these people like a contract to build a massive thing? Looks like they're on the brink of collapse almost.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just a fun thing to watch. This is less true with coal, but I used to be very sort of well-informed about fracking. And fracking has a really terrible return on investment. So the whole thing is basically a Ponzi scheme where you build a couple extractors and then use the money that you make from that to build a couple more extractors. And then the trick is to just like get out of the business before all of it catches up with you. Mm. Anyway, I wonder if Adani's trying to do something similar, trying to like get the coal production started before they run out of money. But anyway,
absolutely. But you think that they might be acting like in bad faith?
Huh.
Is that what you're trying to say, Noon?
I would never say something like that about a multinational coal mining conglomerate.
Careful. You never know when the cops might come and knock in and arrest you for standing on a railway.
And now we're going to move on to...
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey!
Yeah, this week we've got a blurst of takes from none other than Aussie young adult fiction darling, John Marsden, of whom I was just like a massive fan in high school. Smashed the Tomorrow When the War Began books and all of his like much lesser known side novels.
More emo ones.
Yeah, which are almost exclusively about 16-year-old girls discovering their budding sexuality. Who could have guessed that he would say a thing bad enough for us to want to mention it on a podcast? So he's written a new book about parenting. I don't care what it's called. And he's doing a bit of a press tour about it. And he was on Radio National and was giving an interview talking about, you know, the state of parenting today and what it's like for kids, etc. And essentially said that bullying is kind of like a social corrective used by children against kids who have quote-unquote unlikable characteristics.
Huh.
Yeah, It's a bad take.
It's not a really a good bad take.
It's a really bad take. Yeah, if you're bullied, you deserve it because you're just annoying.
You've got to assume that his kids were the bullies and he's now writing this to justify their behavior. I mean,
I don't know if he has kids.
So why the fuck is he writing a book about parenting? It's fine. You don't have to answer that. You're not the one who's...
Yeah, I mean, it really wouldn't surprise me if he had written one without it. But, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm going to cut this whole section.
Cool.
But there's more.
Oh, right. It gets blessed.
Yeah, so he was a teacher. It gets blessed. Yeah. He was a teacher for a while. And he said of Geelong Grammar, where he used to work, they had quite a high percentage of students enrolling from Asian countries, and their acceptance depended very much upon how westernized they were. If they were able to speak English fluently and wear the clothes that Anglo kids wore and listen to the same kind of music, then they were fully accepted. There was absolutely no racism involved. But if they weren't yet at that stage, there was a gulf between them. It didn't necessarily result in bullying, although sometimes it did, but more often, it was sort of a gap between the two subcultures.
I'm impressed at his model of school children, where at one end there's Asian people, and at the other end there's normal people. And the whole of people's social acceptance depends on how close to normal they are.
Oh, yeah. There's this Twitter account called Close But No Potato, which is basically people posting stupid takes and getting really close to like the truth, and then at the last minute like swerving into a bush and catching fire. And so, yeah, I mean, Marsden's sort of quite succinctly explaining the way that white supremacy functions by grading people on a sliding scale of whiteness is... It's like, okay, that's actually quite... Oh boy. And so, wait a minute. They were being mistreated because they were different. But that's not racist. Right?
Yep. I don't know. The last thing that you said about the gap between the subcultures reminds me and Zach went to school together, and there were a lot of Asian kids there, and we're both white. And
how could you tell?
It was really fucking racist. Like, I mean, like, it wasn't normally, like... proactively cruel, aggressive racism, but it was constant background, at least, and like...
1,000,000%. Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, kids are fucking awful.
It's true.
And to say that, like, being, like, psychologically or physically punished by your peers for being unlikable is some kind of, like, appropriate social corrective is just...
Totally.
What the fuck? And, you know, this is a person who... Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, let me ramble about Foucault for half an hour, but I've already been told
that's
not allowed.
You keep trying to get me to let you do that. And I will. Some other time. Yeah, look, just to wrap up, you know, this is a person who we basically entrust a lot of like kids' emotional development to, not only because he was a teacher for ages, but also because he writes books the kids read. And it's like, yeah. Cool. It'll shock you to learn that like he's never written a book with a non-white main character.
Well,
as far as I know, and I've read a lot of his books.
One Asian guy in the Tomorrow series.
Yes. Yeah. His name was Lee.
Oh.
His parents ran an Asian restaurant, and he was extremely good at piano.
Cool.
The memories are really coming flooding back.
And of course, that book was all about. Like a literal yellow peril.
Yeah, well, it's about... It's honestly, like, reading the book as a kid, it never twigged for me. I guess... I don't know. He never sort of, like, explicitly describes the ethnicity of the invaders. But then they did the movie adaptation and they, you know, cast it. It's basically, like, it's Indonesia.
Right.
And I remember watching it and being like, I never pictured it like this. And I was like, oh. Yeah. So... John Marsden, thank you for confirming our suspicions that you clearly don't understand the fuck racism is, and maybe
children,
yeah,
or parenting,
yeah. So maybe you shouldn't be giving anybody advice about how to do anything.
Cool, that was a good blessed take.
Cool. Let us now move on to my favorite segment. Well, I say it's my favorite segment; it's just my favorite sting.
You fucked up.
There it is. It's funny because we just sat in silence for a second because I put all the stings in
what
and post.
Sound
yeah.
Like. Yeah,
and then I did a little fake laugh. Anyway,
moving on.
Okay, so
who fucked up this week, Noon?
Who fucked up?
This week, it was Gladys Berejiklian that fucked up. She's the Premier of New South Wales who...
Until now, flawless record.
Yeah. She... Well, so this is only the most recent fuck-up in a series of, like, a year-long continual fuck-ups.
Rolling shit show.
And this is about the stadium rebuild. So there are two stadiums in Sydney that... Literally no one wants this to happen to, but Gladys has decided...
Was, I think I can think of one person.
Right.
It was Alan Jones.
Alan Jones, who constitutes approximately 50% of the voting public of New South Wales. So there are these two stadiums that are going to be knocked down and rebuilt, and one of them, the Allianz Stadium, the contract for that knockdown and rebuild was given to a company called Lendlease, who is some big conglomerate who do all sorts of infrastructure builds. And so the first stage was to knock down the stadium, and they did that, tick, done. There is now a big hole in the ground where there was once a completely usable stadium.
Great, we're halfway there.
Yeah.
Jobs and growth.
Yeah, and just in the last day or two, Lendlease has decided they don't want to do the second half, the rebuilding part.
Well,
which is obviously
to be
an
fair,
important
part. That does sound
part.
Like the hard part.
That is true. Yeah, yeah. So this is a $729 million budget for rebuilding
shit.
This stadium, which I'm just going to say again was fine before. Like, I mean,
the stadium itself. It wasn't like that warehouse that buys for a dollar,
right?
Coincidentally, the same price that Clive Palmer bought Queensland Nickel for.
$2. Oh, no, it was $1. No, you're right. Yeah, yeah, this is funny. No, it was his wife's $2 company that he bought. Yeah, yeah.
He's buying a lot of companies for single-digit figures, my man. So
anyway, Lendlease.
The stadium was fine. It wasn't falling down.
But it has now fallen down. It's been,
you know,
assisted.
It was pushed.
It was pushed. Yeah, yeah. And just like our microphones just went. Anyway... They've decided they don't want to do the second half, and so the New South Wales government is, like, scrambling to find another company to rebuild this stadium. It's hilarious. They have also been pretending that this was always the plan, and that they always, from the get-go, were only going to do the demolishment.
Oh, massively fucking this up was 100% on the agenda.
Look,
that
they
was
started
a top
off-
line.
The whole project, they're like, what is the worst project that we can do? Yeah, yeah, one that everyone hates, that will do no good for anyone, that will ruin traffic, and won't actually provide any useful infrastructure for the city. Cool.
I mean,
now
it's
let's
like,
do it badly.
Yeah, well, fucking up is built into the very soul and fabric of this entire project. Why not also fuck it up on just like an extremely granular level as well? I mean, I say granular. They left a stadium sized hole in fucking in the city.
The other thing that is just like a little smattering of fuck up on top of this is that Gladys has announced that this will in no way affect the budget or timing of the rebuild. So it's all going to happen on time, on budget, despite no longer having anyone to do it.
Now, that sounds safe.
And, like, not a lie.
So, Gladys, you fucked up.
You did.
Yeah, so...
You started fucking up a long time ago.
Sorry
really...
to say it. So, just before we quit it this week, we wanted to give a shout out to Tasty Wave, who reviewed us on iTunes. Thank you very much, Tasty.
Tasty review.
The little 5 stars there, we appreciate
nice.
That. And, the review goes, usually I can't stand two dudes yammering on at me in my headphones.
Fair.
But these switched on cuties are the exception.
Aw.
Do yourself a favor, my friend. Give them a listen.
It's good advice.
Thank you for the kind words, Tasty.
And if all of you listening at home like the show, please rate us and review us on iTunes.
Yeah, that will be really awesome. And can I just say, like, if you're listening to this, like, thanks. It actually means a lot to us. This is, you know, we're having a lot of fun doing this, and the fact that anybody's listening to it is really nice. And yeah, this nice feedback makes us feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does. It makes it super worthwhile to do it, even though we're, you know, still a small little indie operation. It's really nice knowing that we're getting some listens and that people are enjoying it. So, yeah, hop on over to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a review.
Yeah. Hope you're appreciating the new audio quality. Hopefully it'll get even better in the future as we slowly piece by piece buy
how close or far away to the mic we should stand.
Yeah, we're still figuring out mic distance. But yeah, thank you for sticking with us. You know, if you listen to the first, like, any episode prior to this, that was literally us just plonking down like a recorder. For the first two episodes, we didn't even have headphones. We were just like speaking towards the microphone and hoping that it kind of came through. So if you stuck with us through all of that shit audio,
we hope you're enjoying these dulcet tones.
Let this be your award. We've run long again. Sorry. I swear to God, we're trying to keep it to half an hour. It's tough. It's, you know, podcasting is harder than it looks, harder than it sounds.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you for tuning in. Keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.